I'm very excited about the opportunity to speak with Dr. Michael P. Lynch, professor of philosophy at the University of Connecticut, and the author of a fascinating new book called The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. Professor Lynch, for many, many years, has been interested in how we acquire knowledge and develop understanding, and about the ways in which this whole business of gathering knowledge and developing wisdom and understanding has been changed radically, and perhaps in some really disturbing ways, undermined by some of the technical breakthroughs that have overtaken us at such a rapid degree. And of course, the way in which now we don't go to the bookshelf and we don't go to the lab, we go to Google to find out the answer to some question that we might have. And this is a new way of gathering information and gathering understanding that in some respects shuts us off from new experiences or maybe contrary evidence that might lead us to a deeper and more nuanced understanding of maybe a complicated issue. And of course, we find ourselves in a sharply divided America, and divided not only along lines of values and political attitude, but also divided sharply along lines in terms of what is real, what are the facts, what sources can I trust, and where is all this going to lead? And for those of us disturbed by this turn of events, what can we possibly do about it? Those questions and more posed in this intriguing book, again called The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data, published by W.W. Norton. Professor Michael Lynch, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
I'm really excited to be talking with you. I should mention a previous book of yours called In Praise of Reason, which touches on some of these same issues. Kind of an overarching question right off the bat. I wonder how astounded you are that so much of our human lives have been radically changed in such a short amount of time by the advent of the internet. Are you as astounded as I am that all of this has taken place so quickly?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, I'm 50, and that means that I've, like you, have lived through this change. And I think one of the things that it really is astounding to people my age is that we, not only has it changed so quickly, but we've become acclimated to it so quickly. Right now, I am, you know, somebody who I tweet, I Facebook, I use Google all the time, and I use it not just in my personal life, but of course in my professional life as an academic, as a professor. And it's one of my main sources of information, and that's true for all my colleagues as well. So it's revolutionized the way that we not just relate to each other and talk to each other, but actually communicate, but how we acquire and disseminate knowledge. And that's one of the things that I think is truly astounding, how quickly it's done that. It's not the first such thing to do that. Of course, the printing press, the written word itself, revolutionized how we thought, how we remember, how we gain information, how we know. But the speed of this particular revolution, as you pointed out, is particularly astounding.
You say at one point in your book, the internet didn't create the problem, but it is exaggerating it. And I suppose, in a sense, exacerbating it. I mean, sometimes when we hear the word exaggerate, it means it's making something seem bigger than it is. And I think you're using the word exaggerate in a less common fashion here, meaning that it is worsening the problem, but it didn't create the problem. What created the problem, if not the internet?
Well, it depends on what we mean by what the problem is. I think if the problem that we're talking about, for example, is polarization, which, as you mentioned in your lead-in, which is a problem that I've been very worried about and still am, as I think many of the listeners will be. If that's the problem, the polarization, and not just polarization over values, but polarization over facts, which is the sort of situation we're in now, if that's the problem, then I think the deeper issue is really, well, two other things. One is human psychology, which is that humans, as psychologists tell us, are prone to what they call confirmation bias, which is just a way of saying that we like to go along with whatever information already agrees with our opinions. And that's something that, you know, in a sense, we don't need psychologists to tell us. We know that from our ordinary lives. If we're honest with each other, we know that we tend to pick out the voice in the room that's saying the thing that makes us feel good, agrees with our opinions. So confirmation bias is a fact about human psychology. The other aspect, the second thing, is a sort of philosophical attitude that I think is more recent, but particularly part of the problem or issue as well, polarization. And that's more ideological. It's philosophical. It's the idea that truth is something not so much that we discover through inquiry, but something that we can actually mold or create. It's the idea that reality is shapeable or can be shaped by us. And that's the sort of view that we can, in a sense, is both feeds into polarization and is partly a product of polarization. There's sort of a feedback loop. So we have people sort of thinking now, because there's so much disagreement, over not just issues of values, as I mentioned, such as abortion or the death penalty, but over, you know, the size of inauguration crowds and over vaccines and over matters that we would have thought were straightforward matters of fact. There's so much polarization that people start to think maybe there really aren't any facts anymore, and maybe maybe it really just comes down to just believing the person who has the loudest voice in the room.
Right.
So I think those are problems that pre-existed the internet. But what the internet does is it makes those problems, it amplifies those factors of our experience.
Mm. One of the interesting distinctions one can make as we read your book and think more deeply about some of these questions is by making more distinction between what information is and what knowledge is. And I think you are talking about knowledge not just being where your brain is this file box and it's stuffed with information and facts and knowledge and so on, but knowledge, the word knowledge implies something deeper, something with some grounding.
That's right. When we talk about it, we can actually make a couple different distinctions here that I think are helpful. On one hand, we can talk about data, which is really the raw material of our input, either into our computer or into our brains. And that raw material, once we give it meaning, is information. But information can be good or bad, true or false. So knowledge, when we talk about knowledge, what we're talking about is having the accurate information, but more than that, because you can have an accurate information through a lucky guess. Not knowing something isn't merely being lucky; it's having some, as you say, some grounds for your opinion, some evidence. And that, you know, for one of the things that was important for the development of science, and that came out during the Enlightenment, was the key notion of evidence, the idea that when you know something, you really have to have some evidence for your claim. And yet, of course, if you really do know it, it is accurate. You have evidence for it, and of course, it's a bit of information. So knowledge, I think, is a deeper thing than just information. But knowledge itself can come in different kinds. There can be the sort of knowledge one can have when one consults an expert. That's a sort of passive knowing. And that's the sort of knowing that we do in a way when we consult good sources on the Internet. But we can also know in a deeper way by grasping how things fit together, seeing their ultimate underlying causes. And when we do something like that, we're really engaging in a form of knowing I call understanding. And that's the most difficult form of knowing. It's the sort of knowing we really want to achieve in our lives, both about we want to understand our friends and family members. We want to understand our political foes. And we want to understand how the world works.
I think what you're suggesting, however, in your book is that there aren't enough people interested in going after that, and that's one reason why we find ourselves in this situation that I think you like to call knowledge polarization, because if we don't have a hunger to understand complicated matters in a nuanced fashion beyond just what our own gut instinct tells us or our own personal experience, however limited it is, if we are content to know that and believe that and nothing more, and if I'm over here believing this and you're over there believing that, then we end up with this polarization on a whole different level than we have maybe seen before.
Exactly right. I think this is one of the deepest problems and most terrifying problems actually confronting us, because it's a problem that, as a culture, because it's a problem that if we can't solve it, if we can't solve the problem of knowledge polarization, then we're going to have a hard time solving the other pressing issues like climate change, for example, that we're facing right now as a society. Again, as you pointed out, the issue is that we not, in fact, it's even, I said earlier that we're disagreeing over facts, but it goes even deeper than that, because real knowledge polarization occurs when we're not just disagreeing over values, we're not just disagreeing over the facts, we're disagreeing over whose sources of evidence are reliable, what sources can be trusted, what standards and principles of evidence can be trusted. Once the disagreement gets that deep, when we're disagreeing over, for example, whether science is trustworthy or not with regard to, let's say, evolution or the age of the earth or vaccines, when we're disagreeing to that extent, then it's very difficult to see how to fight our way back to reason, to the light of reason. Because, of course, anything I say in defense of my own views, if you're disagreeing with my methods and sources, you will find my claims to be sort of question begging, because of course they're just relying on my own sources, and those are the things you're doubting. I think, you know, in the early days of the internet, digital technology seemed to make knowing for ourselves, for example, so much easier. And in many ways, of course, it does. The internet has become more of a part of our lives. You know, however, our use of it has become more passive. Much of what I think we know today, what I call in the book Google Know. We download prepackaged sets of facts and sort of push them along the assembly line of social media. And, you know, Google Knowing is useful precisely because it's a sort of outsourcing. We offload our cognitive effort onto other people. And that's great because we don't have to clutter our minds, right, to remember certain facts. We just download them when we need them. But there's a really profound difference, right, between downloading sets of facts and understanding why or how those facts are the way they are, and really understanding why a disease spreads or how a mathematical proof works is an achievement. It's something that you work towards, and you can't just download it into your own sort of information bubble. And so these information bubbles that we're sort of curating for ourselves on social media end up feeding into the sort of passive way of acquiring information, and that can lead, I think, and lead to this knowledge polarization we're talking about.
We're speaking with Michael P. Lynch about his book, The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. As I was reading about your book and of what you had to say about Google knowing, knowledge acquired online, I realized that when I first read those words, I sort of took umbrage at them, because in my mind I'm thinking, well, what's the difference if I found this in World Book Encyclopedia, you know, a book sitting on my lap, versus online on a screen? But then I realized, you know, the more I thought about it, I realized that the more we are Googling for information and online, which is this vast universe, most of which is unedited and in a sense unguided. That's where we really get into trouble. because everything is out on the internet, including all kinds of outlandish information, including all kinds of propaganda on both sides. And if that is the only place we go searching for information, we're almost bound to be filling ourselves with information that, in a sense, isn't worth acquiring.
Well, that can definitely be the case, and I think that a sort of basic truth of all of our lives right now is that the internet is both the world's greatest fact checker. You know, when we get in a dispute with somebody, what do we do? We race to the phones and, you know, try to Google it and find out who's right. So it's and that we all do that, and it's, even if we often think it's annoying when it's done to us, it is a way of fact-checking, but it's also, as I was saying earlier, that one of the world's greatest bias confirmer, and that's what you're getting at, is that it can basically, any particular bias or prejudice or view, crazy or not, that you have, you can find some support for it, or support in quotes, in air quotes, on the internet.
Right.
But, you know, the thing that you brought up a really good point, which is that what's really the difference between looking online and reading something in a book? Well, I think in one way, of course, there's a lot of similarities. When we go to we sometimes even think of the internet as a giant library where we're just going and getting the books that we want. And to some extent, that's right. It is the case that libraries contain lots of information, some good, some bad, and so do encyclopedias. And the internet contains, in a certain sense, metaphorically, lots of information, both good and bad. But that's really where the similarity ends. Because actually, going onto the internet for information is, by its very nature, very different from going to a library. And let me explain. You could think about and I want to emphasize before I go on to explain that it's different, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily worse. In many ways, it's actually better. The big difference is what we might call the personalization of the internet. The internet doesn't just get us more information. It's not just a bigger library. What's the magic of the internet, the magic of Google, for example, is that it gets us precisely the information we want. And that's because our online life is personalized. You know, everything from the ads we read if you're reading the New York Times, the ads that'll come across your page online, to the political news in your Facebook feed, it's all tailored to satisfy our particular preferences. So it's easier than ever to get and share information, but the information we get often reflects ourselves, and that's due to how the internet works. The internet tracks the searches and movement that you, metaphorical movement that you engage in online, and that information is not filtered by any particular person, but by algorithms that allow advertisers to know what it is that you seem to be interested in,
right?
What you want.
You know, as you describe that, it reminds me of something a little contrary to that, but it's a very isolated information that when one goes to Wikipedia, the front page of Wikipedia, typically at the top, has some sort of article of the day, and it will be about Joseph Stalin or the
right.
Marriage of Figaro or the soccer player Pele, and it's not there on your screen because you asked for it. All you asked for was Wikipedia, but they just
right.
serve up this little article that has nothing to do with why you brought up Wikipedia in the first place. And in a sense, that's more like when you're reading yourself to sleep with World Book, like I did as a youngster.
Exactly. Wikipedia is a much, you know, is in on the that in terms of the history of internet technology and information technology, Wikipedia is a very, very old-fashioned approach to things, which is funny to say because there was not too long ago where academics like myself got all worked up about Wikipedia. I personally think that Wikipedia is a very, you know, relatively speaking, a pretty good source of information. But it's old-fashioned because it isn't really as personalized as much of the other information we get online. When, you know, when the sort of apex of personalization, I think, came about with the advent of things like Google Complete, which is the very useful bit of algorithms that allows Google to literally know you so much that it can finish your sentences. So when you get online, right, and you type in a search, Google will prompt you. Will say, "Well, you're searching for shoes, and you know, and we'll help you try to finish that sentence. Is climate change a?" And it might helpfully suggest, as it actually often does for people, a hoax. Is it real? Those sorts of questions. If you type "client," you can try that right now. Is climate change A, and see what you get from Google. What that does, of course, is direct people. So it does direct people. It is guided in a way. It's just guided by, in a sense, your own preferences and other people's preferences. That's what makes it so different from a library. It's as if the Internet is like a library in this sense. You walk into a library and all the shelves change their contents. The books are different as you walk down the shelves. The books rearrange themselves in order to reflect what it seems, according to the library, you would like to see. And so that guidance is really coming from, in a sense, all of our preferences aggregated. And that's great if you're looking for shoes. It's not great if what you're trying to do is find some understanding, the sort of thing we were talking about earlier.
Right.
Because that, it sort of bumps up against a fundamental point that I think I emphasize in the book, and I think a lot of us deep down really think is important, which is that preference does not equal truth.
Right. And particularly, I was thinking, for instance, if we're talking about a vexing social ill like poverty, all the people in America that live in poverty, there are some people who at the heart of their being are operating from the presumption that the vast majority of these people have been, in a sense, given a raw deal, and by life or by life circumstances beyond their control, and if they just need a fair chance to do what they can do. And then there's others who operate from a different sort of gut feeling that the vast majority of these people are there because they sort of deserve to be there, because they've made some stupid choices, they've made some stupid mistakes, they've undermined what might have been, you know, something successful by making some bad choices. And if we are looking at the same population and the same problem, but starting with those two different sort of gut feelings, that will be the filter through which we take in all of the information after that to bolster our own understanding about why so many people are living in poverty. And we seem to see that over all kinds of different issues right now.
Exactly. And what the very same algorithms that allow us to get so much information that we want in order to do things like buy shoes or even look up a scientific article online, those same algorithms actually sharpen those filters that you were talking about, or to switch metaphors, they inflate our bubbles rather than bursting them. And that ultimately is what makes or should make us concerned about how we're learning things online now. I do want to emphasize that I'm not suggesting that we stop Google knowing. That, you know, absolutely not. It's too much of a part of our fabric of existence. In the same way, I wouldn't suggest that we stop reading or talking to each other. I mean, it's just a way that we acquire our beliefs now. But what I am suggesting is that we all start taking a little bit more responsibility for how we're engaging with information online and off. And
I think beyond that, you're also calling for all of us on whichever side of the aisle that we are on to approach all of this with greater humility. In fact, you are part of a research project right now, I believe, called Humility and Conviction in Public Life. Tell the listeners what this is about and the kind of humility that you would like more of us to acquire and with which to view the world around us.
Right, thanks. Yes, I here at the University of Connecticut, we are leading this this initiative to try to repair our fractured public discourse. And the way we think about it, it is through this concept, these concepts of humility and conviction. You know, you can't, democracies can't function if they're, if the electorate doesn't have some commitments, some convictions. An apathetic electorate is no electorate at all. On the other hand, we also can't function if we're not willing to listen to one another, to listen to one another not just in order to wait our turn until it's time to talk, but to actually listen for the possibility of learning from each other. And that's the sort of what I call humility or intellectual humility that I think we really need to find ways of encouraging people to have in our culture right now. By this sort of humility, what I mean is being willing to see your own worldview as open to improvement by the evidence and experience that others might bring to the table. That's more than just being open, let's say, to change, right? It's more than just being interested in self-improvement. It's seeing the possibility that, you know, you could learn something from somebody who has different views on some fundamental matters than your own.
Right. And whether you are a staunch conservative or a bleeding heart liberal or someplace in between, that is, in this day and age, a fairly radical notion. And if more of us were willing to undertake that, I mean, and honestly, I mean, not just paying it lip service, but undertaking that kind of attitude in a very real way, think of the difference that could make.
Indeed. I think of it, I ask people sometimes to think of it in terms of what sort of attitudes towards themselves and towards others do you want your children to have? And certainly this attitude of intellectual humility, this willingness to see yourself as open to improvement, not, you know, with regard to your beliefs, that's and open to the evidence, those sorts of attitudes, those are the attitudes we really want to, and we do, encourage in our children. And so it should be, those should be attitudes that we should work to encourage in ourselves. And so at the university here, we have teamed with 10 different groups of researchers around the world to look at how we can encourage and test ways of encouraging the adoption of this sort of attitude in our public discourse, whether we're talking online, as some of our researchers are working on, or if we're just looking into, as some researchers are working on with us, how the brain functions on dogmatism, so to speak, and how we can get, perhaps learn from that investigation, how the brain might function if it was actually being less dogmatic. So those are the sorts of things that we're trying to look into, and I encourage people listening to look at our website, Humility and Conviction, at the University of Connecticut.
Very good. We want people to also seek out your book, The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data, and you are the featured guest in the next TED Talk. In 30 seconds, tell us about that.
That's about common reality and why we need to start believing in it again, because otherwise, without a sense of common reality, there is no hope for engaging with each other in humility or with conviction. We need to believe that we're all in one world.
Dr. Michael Lynch, professor of philosophy at the University of Connecticut, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.